Thanks, guys. Good morning. Every day, all of us make hundreds of choices. Do we want Starbucks or Peet's? Coke or Pepsi? You want Burger King or McDonald's? How about In-N-Out? How about Mac or PC? You want a Toyota or a Honda? How about plasma or LCD? You want to attend Stanford or Cal? We're not having a basketball game today. Every day, we make choices. We make choices about cars, food, clothing, vacations, activities, and careers. And it's really mind-boggling when you think about the many, many decisions that we are forced to make. Even the children, you children that are here this morning are facing a lot of choices already in your life. And maybe today it would be a good time to talk about those choices that you're making with your parents and explore those choices and allow your parents to shed some light on those choices. Whether we're aware of it or not, we make many of our decisions based upon what will enhance or benefit our lives. In other words, we hope to derive pleasure, contentment, fulfillment, satisfaction, or comfort from our choices. So, for example, we don't just buy a car only for transportation. We want the identity it offers and the life that the advertisement promises. But we also make spiritual choices. What church to attend, what books to read, what Bible study to join, but most importantly, what to believe and how deeply to believe it. And like all of our other choices, our motivation is for life, although when it comes to spiritual choices, we are either embracing or rejecting the life of God. And people all over the world every day are making spiritual decisions that have huge ramifications in their life, both for the present and for the future. Now, in the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead that we have been looking at the last couple of weeks, Martha is asked to make a choice. Jesus tells Martha that he is the resurrection and the life. And then he asks her, do you believe this? And Martha affirms her belief in Jesus. But as the story unfolds, we realize that her faith has a ways to go. At the decisive moment when Jesus tells her to roll the stone away from the front of the tomb, Martha is hesitant to take action consistent with the statement of belief. She's forced to make a choice as to whether Jesus can truly raise the dead, not only in the last day, but also in the present. Martha is forced to take her belief to a deeper level than she had ever imagined. Now, not only is Martha asked to make a choice, but others who were present at that tomb on that day were forced to respond as well to this incredible miracle. And not only were those present forced to respond, but also those who heard the report or who read the account of John, including us. The story asks everyone who saw it or hears about it whether Jesus truly is the resurrection and the life. And the story asks everyone who professes belief as to how much the life of Jesus will impact them. How much are we willing to risk? How much are we willing to give for the life that Jesus offers to us? Every day we make choices, life choices with huge consequences. Now, as we continue in John's story, we see people's response to this climactic sign of Jesus. And we also see one of the primary obstacles that keep us from experiencing resurrection life. The initial response we see in verse 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now, it's very interesting to note that nothing much more is said of Lazarus after he came out of that tomb. But instead, John now turns his attention to the response of the people who were there. There was a large crowd of witnesses who had gathered that day. They had come from Jerusalem to support the family and to be particularly with Mary in her grief. We talked about that last week, that Mary had a lot of friends who came to be with her and support her. We see here two initial responses. On the one hand, there were those who believed in Jesus and attributed the miracle to the glory of God. Now, the degree of their faith is not indicated. John tells us elsewhere that the faith of some of these people was pretty spurious and would wilt under pressure. But the indication is that there were those who saw, gave glory to God, and began to believe that Jesus truly was who he said he was. On the other hand, there were those who went to the Pharisees. Now, one could hope that they were going to try to win the Pharisees to Jesus, but probably their intent was much more malicious. They wanted to go and give a report, stir up the pot, make trouble. When you think about it, it is absolutely amazing that anyone who would have watched Lazarus come out of that tomb would have made a choice to harden their heart and not accept that this miracle came from God. That's amazing, isn't it? And yet, that's what we see in beginning to happen in this response to this miracle. That's how hard and callous the hearts of some of those people were. They chose to reject it. So here you see this polar response to Jesus. And once again in John, the fact that Jesus always causes division. Several years ago, I took my brother-in-law to our annual men's retreat. He was not a believer at the time. And during the weekend, we began to talk about spiritual things and about how he was responding to the weekend. And he made this comment. He said, you know, you would have to be a fool not to want what these men have. And yet people play the fool, don't they? They see the miracle, they see the life, and yet they perceive the gospel as foolish and make a choice to live in darkness. See, God never forces the gospel down our throat. He doesn't force us to believe, although one man in early service reminded me that he sure came kicking and screaming. But he gives us this freedom, a freedom to choose. Well, next we see the response of the authority upon hearing the news of those who came from the tomb. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So they had a meeting. Now, this council certainly was the a meeting of the Sanhedrin, consisting of 70 members. It was the highest judicial body in the land. It was like our Supreme Court. The Sanhedrin controlled all Jewish internal affairs. And it was dominated by the chief priests, who were drawn from the extended family of the high priest. Virtually all of the priests were Sadducees. Remember, the Sadducees come from a wealthy class. They're the aristocrats. While the Pharisees are more the blue-collar workers that are very much interested in keeping the law. The two groups were not particularly fond of each other. But here we see the two joining forces to face a common enemy. What we see here is a classic damage control meeting. How are we going to handle the fallout of the Lazarus affair? You know, they're concerned about the press and how the media is going to report this event. Jesus' popularity is rising, and the recent polls are alarming. The spin doctors and word mongers are summoned to an emergency conference. The leaders are in a panic, and they're asking, "What are we going to do?" You know. They realize they have to take action because things are getting out of hand. Now, what caused these authorities to be so fearful and so alarmed? What are they afraid of? Well, John tells us that they feared the reaction of the Romans. See, these authorities were operating out of certain messianic expectations. If people believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the one that they have been waiting for, then popular messianic expectations are going to reach a fever pitch. And in turn, this is going to lead to conflict with the Romans. And this is going to be a mess because this Jesus, this Messiah, doesn't seem like someone who is going to guarantee victory over the Romans. This guy is not a William Wallace or a Rambo or a John Wayne. This Jesus is much more interested in healing people. So if there's a conflict with Rome, the authorities fear losing their place and their nation. If the Romans sense rebellion, they're going to come in and they're going to tighten down the clamps. Place is almost certainly a reference to the temple, and nation is a reference to the semi-autonomous status of the Jewish nation. That's what they fear, losing their temple and their ability to govern themselves, at least partially. And I'm sure these authorities also fear losing their places of power and prestige. What's the issue? The issue is control. Control. They don't want to lose control. And therefore, they are opposed to Jesus and his popularity. Now, next, John turns his attention to the high priest, Caiaphas, who stands up in the midst of this meeting, in the midst of this assembly, and he gives a little speech. One of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish." Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Now, Caiaphas is a very interesting character. He was high priest in Israel, in Jerusalem, from A.D. 18 to A.D. 36, when both he and Pontius Pilate were sacked at the same time. The high priest presided over the Sanhedrin. The Old Testament specified that the high priest would serve for life. And yet, at this point in history, the office of high priest was very political, and the ruling overlord could dispose of a high priest at any time. John tells us that he was priest in that year. And he says that twice, both in verses 49 and in 51. That fateful year, that memorable year, or perhaps it's an indication that Caiaphas has to kind of ante up every year to see if he's going to be in that position, continue in that position. Well, in the midst of this meeting, Caiaphas stands up and he proclaims abruptly, "You know nothing at all." What a great line. Josephus says the Sadducees were barbarous and wild, even towards those of their own party. And Caiaphas' remark certainly bears that out. The irony is that he speaks truth better than he knows, because they really don't know anything at all. They think they know, but they don't know. And then Caiaphas makes this prophecy that one man, namely Jesus, should die for the nation. And not only for the nation, but for all the children of God who were scattered abroad. This is a reference to the Jewish diaspora. Caiaphas is interested in keeping peace with Rome. Jesus can be a scapegoat. To die for the people and the nation is sacrificial language. The sacrifice of a few for the many is good politics. What we see in the response of Caiaphas is the response of a secular leader. Caiaphas is a politician. He is not a believer in God. The Pharisees and Sadducees are in bed together, and they all accept the advice of Caiaphas. The word plan means resolved. And so these authorities made a decision and begin to plot out how they can put Jesus to death. They're probably trying to figure out how they can get the Romans to accomplish that task. This Jesus who gives life by raising from the dead. This Jesus who sets captives free from the tomb is going to experience the death that these authorities are planning for him. Now, these are amazing verses. This about the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas. And what we see is John's irony comes now to the highest point. And we see at least four ironic comparisons. One, Caiaphas states that one man, for it's better for one man to die for the nation and, of course, for the ruling party. Again, Caiaphas speaks better than he knows. His words have a double meaning. In reality, Jesus would die for the children of God. But the real children of God are going to be those who believe in his name. The double meaning is that God will call his sheep from many folds, and he will make them one in Jesus. This anticipates the Gentile mission. The Jews are referred to both as a people and a nation, but both of those terms are taken over by the church. See, according to Peter, the church now is a holy nation. Two, Caiaphas is the high priest. And as the high priest, he would enter the holy place on Passover to make atonement with the shed blood on behalf of the people. Ironically, this high priest plots the shedding of the blood of the good shepherd who will give his life for the sheep, the very thing to which the ritual has always pointed. The high priest thinks it's a small price to pay for the nation, and yet this price will be sufficient for the whole world. Three, the religious authorities fear the destruction of the temple. So what do? They plot the destruction of the true temple. And four, the religious authorities fear the destruction of their nation. So they plot to destroy true Israel, God's son. They reject Jesus as Messiah. But in a few decades, they're going to follow a false Messiah who will lead them into the destruction they are now seeking to avoid. Ironically, Jesus is going to die, but the nation is going to perish anyway. And the temple will be torn down stone by stone, and the nation will be lost. See, Caiaphas reveals to us the sovereignty of God. God allowed Caiaphas to speak his opinion, but amazingly, God is speaking as well. Caiaphas acted unknowingly as the mouthpiece and the agent of God's plan. Even though the authorities are plotting Jesus' death, everything is in God's hands, and no human court is going to decide his fate. See, you understand what this means? That God uses even the selfish choices, the evil plans, and the murderous intention of mankind to serve his redemptive purposes. God is going to have his way. He will even use disobedience to bring about his will. He's going to use both sides. The authorities are playing out a role in a foreordained drama. These authorities are not in control, even though they think they are. The world is not in control, even though they think it is. Everything is being used for God's purposes. These authorities are given the freedom to choose, but God is always going to play trump. Finally, we see the response of Jesus. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with his disciples. Jesus leaves the scene at this point and goes about 12 miles away from Jerusalem. I'm not sure he's seeking safety. He just knows his hour has not yet come, but it's going to come in a few weeks when it's time for the Passover, and he's going to go for his last time into Jerusalem. Now, I entitled the message today, Life Choices, because God forces every person to make choices. Spiritual choices, choices for life and death. And John is helpful to us, very helpful in understanding our choices and seeing these choices, at least in three ways. The first way he's helpful is because he helps us understand the attitude of the world towards Jesus. The world can have and does have a very hostile reaction to Jesus. Have you ever observed this? See, we know this, don't we? Often that response is cruel or harsh. Sometimes it's sarcastic or it's apathetic. Even though Jesus is the one who raises the dead to life. And why would we expect anything different? You know, the world is in rebellion against God. The world loves the darkness. It hates the light. You can talk about all sorts of abstract religious ideas, spiritual ideas. You can talk about any other religion other than Christianity just fine. The world is willing to buy in and embrace and accept almost anything other than Jesus. The world is willing to embrace the fictionalized and unsupported truth of a movie like Da Vinci Code. And yet, it will reject the truth about Jesus, even though there's all the historical evidence in the world to bear out the truth of his death and resurrection. At the mention of Jesus and the cross, a friendly conversation can turn very weird and very strange and very quickly, and people might shout in your face, "You know nothing at all." You know, one of the reasons the world reacts this way to Jesus is the same reason that we see in the lives of these religious authorities. The world wants control. It wants control. It doesn't want to give up control. The world wants power and prestige and pleasure, just like these religious authorities. The world wants to believe that it can control its destiny and get life from its choices, its own choices, through its own strength. The world wants a Messiah who is going to win, doesn't cramp their style. They don't want to admit weakness or failure or defeat. The world wants to live in darkness and choose sin whenever and wherever it pleases. But the irony is the world is never in control. People are not in control, even though they think they are. The irony is that those things that people think will give them life will only bring death. They think that they have freedom and yet they're enslaved. They can't have the life of God on their own terms. And yet, it's into this dark and hostile world that God came. God came knowing what would happen in order to gather his children and create a new nation. Nothing that the world does can impede God's intentions and God's purposes. And God even uses rebellion and disobedience to bring about his will. The world can never outsmart God to maintain power or control. God is not alarmed at how the world responds to Jesus, and neither should we. And just like Jesus was sent into the world, so too we are in the world. We may be met with hostility and hatred in our families or in our workplace. We don't have to try to make it happen. It's just going to happen as we share the truth about Jesus. This shouldn't surprise us. There's darkness all around us. But in the midst of the darkness, there are people who are being called by God, people who want life, people who are willing to give up control, to believe that there is a Messiah, that there is someone from God that can bring life out of death and give them hope and give them joy. And our mission as believers, if indeed we're a believer, is to continue that mission and to be a faithful witness to Jesus and share the truth that he's given to us, despite the response that we might receive. But then John also helps us to understand one of the biggest problems in the church. The world is not the only place where the life of Jesus is rejected. How many of you have encountered church leaders who are more interested in building their own kingdom than the kingdom of God? It seems that the church is a fertile soil for high control, ambitious, self-serving leaders. Some leaders can be as adept at playing the political game as any politician or business person. I know many of you have probably encountered those kind of leaders. You've been in churches where you've seen the power struggles and the struggle for control. See, the primary fear for these kinds of leaders is the same thing that motivated the Sanhedrin to plot Jesus' death. They fear losing control. They fear losing the place of power. They fear what might happen if people really start believing that this Jesus is the Messiah and this Jesus can give them life. They feel threatened when the Spirit begins to work in someone's life or when someone's ministry in the congregation becomes too visible. So what do? They try to eliminate anybody who is a threat to their power and their control. They try to kill the life of Jesus for their own selfish interest. And sadly, there's way, way too many examples of these kinds of leaders within the church. But again, God is not alarmed. God's committed to His church. He's committed to His people. And He's going to continue to work through the church, sometimes in spite of itself. The story tells us that God is still in control. And God is working out His redemptive purposes in the lives of His people. And often that life is in the people that are sitting in the pews. As they use their gifts, as they embrace Jesus, they begin to spread the gospel and become Jesus to the world. And God is never going to allow that to stop. But John finally is also helpful to point out what can keep us from the life of God. The story asks all of us to take a look at our lives as well. Because each day we face choices. Choices that have huge consequences. And God gives us that freedom. See, and people in the world and people in church leadership are not the only ones who have a hard time giving up control of their life. We have the same problem, don't we? We don't want to give up control. And this is one of the biggest obstacles for living in resurrection life. The choices we make revolve around trusting in the life of Jesus and bringing that life into everything that we do and every choice that we make. We're motivated to gain life. And that's why we want to control our environment, because we want to guarantee that we're going to experience life. And yet, if we're not allowing this resurrection life of Jesus to impact our every decision and our every thought, if we push Him out to the side, if we say, wait a minute, Jesus, let me take this one. I'll come back to you a little later, but I just want to make this happen right now for myself. Then we're not going to be experiencing the resurrection life that we so desire. See, resurrection is a miracle. Think about it. Resurrection is a miracle. It's a miracle. Resurrection is a 100% gift. There is nothing that we do to enhance or to increase the magnitude or dimensions of resurrection life. Nothing. But we do have to receive it. And we have to allow its entrance into our everyday events. It's hard to describe, though, isn't it? What do we do to allow resurrection to enter into the smallest parts of our life? Well, let me describe what it means for me. It involves accepting where God has you and what He has for you, rather than thinking life will come from a different set of circumstances. It means bearing the crosses that God has given you rather than the ones you would rather carry. It means giving up your anger or resentment or grudges and believing that God is working out His purposes despite the malicious intents of others. It means not allowing your heart to grow hard and callous because of the injustice you have suffered, but trusting that God has higher goals and higher plans for His kingdom. It means forgiving and letting go of your deepest pain, believing that nothing can thwart the work of God's redeeming love in your life. It means stop trying to define your future and allow God to have His way in your life. It may mean this morning reaching out in compassion and greeting somebody that's here this morning, loving them, someone you don't even know, instead of worrying about and caring about and obsessing about finding your belonging with people that you do know, your acceptance and your approval. How much of the life of Jesus do we want? He'll give us everything if we're willing to open up our hearts and receive it into every aspect of our life. My grandmother was, she was the sweetest lady and a very strong believer, even though she was abused and abandoned by an alcoholic husband. She was left to raise four daughters on her own, and she did so. She painted like Grandma Moses. And when I was a child, she'd constantly read stories to me every night when she came for visits. When I became a believer in my early 20s, I was given the gift of her Bible. And in those early days of knowing Christ, I just poured through all the notes that she had written, all the prayers that she had written in her Bible, and I found this incredible, incredible treasure chest. Every time I opened it, it was like the life of God just swept over me. And she wrote something in that Bible that she wanted read at her funeral. And it's been a great source of encouragement to me, and I just want to read a bit of that to you. Let us turn to the grave scene of Lazarus and hear the promise made not merely to Martha, but to us. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he die, yet shall he live. This is the promise of eternal life, a thing all men desire, but few are willing to accept on God's terms. The greatest of all sins is the sin of unbelief. The sin of unbelief is as truly sin as murder. You may be a child of God, but if you doubt God's promises, you are going to suffer the lack of their fulfillment. Read the Bible as you would read any human will. Ask God to cleanse you from every vestige of unbelief, and then occupy your mind with Christ. If He is not first in your life, you do not know the first principles of joy. If He is first, He can make up for anything you have lost. Thanks be to God for His unspeakable gift. Let's close.